Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
In the early 1980s, baseball films were rare, with the most notable being the 1976 comedy, The Bad News Bears. However, Barry Levinson's 1984 Oscar-nominated flick sparked a resurgence, leading to over 18 baseball-themed films in the next decade. On the surface, it appears as a traditional sports biopic, but it reveals deeper, almost artistic layers upon closer examination. It transcends mere athletic drama to become a quintessentially American fable and a crowd-pleasing fairy tale. The story follows Roy Hobbs, a gifted baseball player whose career is tragically derailed. Years later, he reappears as an aging outfielder for the fictional New York Knights, armed with his mystical bat, Wonder Boy. As Hobbs propels the underdog team towards victory, he confronts his past and battles formidable challenges, embodying the drama and spirit of America's beloved game in a narrative of redemption and myth. So grab some peanuts and Cracker Jack to snack on while Nicholas Pepin, Ben Carpenter, and I discuss The Natural from 1984 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
Someday when people look at me, they'll say, there goes Roy Hobbs, the best there ever was.
TriStar Pictures presents Robert Redford in The Natural, the story of a father and a son.
My dad wanted me to be a baseball player.
A man and a woman.
I'm not waiting for true love to come along, Roy.
A champion and his destiny.
A Roy Hobbs comes along once, maybe twice in everybody's lifetime.
The Natural, rated PG. Starts Friday at a theater.
I'm Tim Williams, the mastermind behind the mic at the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Joining me on each epic episode is a guest co-host who's as crazy about 80s flicks as they are about wearing parachute pants and solving Rubik's Cubes. We're diving into nostalgic treasures we saw at the local theater, rented on VHS tapes, or discovered on cable TV. From blockbusters that make you say,
I feel the need for speed,
to hidden gems that'll have you screaming,
they're here.
It's a blast to relive these old memories and share our thoughts on what made these movies so special. We reminisce about our first time watch experiences, share our favorite scenes, and even discover fascinating behind the scenes tales about the cast and crew along the way. Haven't hit that subscribe button yet? What are you waiting for?
Come on, do it!
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. And hey, while you're at it, be a pal and drop us a written review along with a 5-star rating to tell us what you think about us.
The sportos and motorheads, geeks, sluts, bloods, wastoids, dweebies, they all adore him. They think he's a righteous dude.
Take a day off and come hang out with us on social media. Just search 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And don't forget to bookmark 80sflickflashback.com for more gnarly content.
Get out of town. I didn't know you did anything creative.
Want to crank it all the way up to 11? Become a supporter on buymeacoffee.com for only $5 a month.
Do or do not. There is no try.
Click the link in our episode show notes, and while you're there, soak up the extra trivia and fun stuff that didn't make it into today's show. Thanks again for tuning in. Now, let's get right into today's episode.
Welcome to the party, pal.
All right, well, welcome in, everybody. So glad to have you on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. We're talking about a movie that I'll say up front, I had not seen before watching it for the podcast. So it's kind of a rarity here. I've done a few in the past, but it's been a while since I've watched one for the first time. But this is one that's been highly recommended, and glad to have two wonderful co-hosts with me to talk about The Natural from 1984. Welcome back to the show, Nicholas Pepin from Pop Culture Roulette. How you doing, Nicholas?
All right. How about you?
I'm good, man. And because he had to suffer through Jaws 3D, give him a good one this time. Welcome back, Ben Carpenter.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back and glad to be talking about a good movie this time.
Right. All right. Well, let's jump right in. So, Nicholas, when did you see The Natural for the very first time?
When I was in college. See, now I couldn't remember if I borrowed it from you or from Keith, because you both had equally impressive film libraries. But given what you just said, I now know that I borrowed it from Keith.
Yeah, and knowing Keith, this is a movie that Keith would own and probably watched on a regular basis. I believe that. Very true.
Yeah. So that would have been, and it's not a movie that I watch a lot, so I don't know if I've seen it since then.
Gotcha.
But, yeah.
Gotcha.
I had definitely seen it before rewatching it for this.
Cool. So what about you, Ben? Is this one you saw when you were younger?
Well, I was 11 when it came out in theaters. I don't remember seeing it in the theater, but I do remember watching it over at my grandparents' house. At the time, they had HBO, or as my grandmother called it, the home box office. She never referred to it as the abbreviated name. And, we didn't have HBO at home then, but, you know, when I was at my grandparents' house, I would sometimes just sit and, you know, HBO would show the same movie seemingly more hours or more times per day as there were hours in the day, but they would just show it over and over. And I probably watched it several times then on the home box office.
There you go. Very cool. Yeah, this is one that I remember. So we had HBO when I was younger, and I remember this one being pretty heavily advertised, and I'm sure it was on, and for whatever reason, it was just not one that I gravitated towards. And I don't know if it's because it was like a more of a, it's a period piece. So it's set in the 30s, 20s and 30s. And I can't even say at that age, I was really that big of a baseball fan, because at that time we lived in North Carolina. So there were no like major league baseball teams close by that I would follow. And I really didn't know who the Braves were until we moved to Georgia, you know, having TBS and being close to the Braves. So it wasn't something that I just kind of gravitated towards, but I remember I watched the trailer a couple of times, you know, getting ready before I watched the movie. And it was like, I remember those scenes from the trailer. Like, I remember those more than anything else. So it's definitely one that it was just a blind spot in my filmography or my library that I haven't watched, but I enjoyed it. I don't think it's, you know, spoiler alert, I don't think it's as great as people have kind of puffed it up to be. I mean, I think it's good, but it has some
glaring things.
it feels incomplete. And I feel like there was a lot of stuff that just, and maybe because we're used to movies being longer and telling more of a backstory. And I know there's a director's cut with like, this says it's only 5 minutes longer, but it does tell more about him as a boy, like, or, you know, younger story, I think, in the director's cut.
Does it not tell a little bit more about the aftermath, you know, of the incident?
Yeah.
I think it gets into that a little bit.
I think
more.
It does too. Yeah. I know the book, and we'll talk a little bit about the difference between the book. Have either one of you read the book?
I didn't even know there was a book until I was doing the research. So
yeah, same here.
Right, me either. So usually I have Laramie on. He's usually the big book reader, so he's read the books, but he didn't jump out of this one. So obviously not one that he's read. But I know the movie is very different from the book, and we'll talk about some of the differences there. But I know the book tells a lot more about his early life, and especially the lady that, if you haven't seen it yet, we're going to spoil a lot of it, but, you know, he gets shot fairly early in the movie, but there was actually a longer history between the two of them in the novel. So it wasn't so kind of a random out of the blue occurrence like it feels in the movie. And that when it happened in the movie, I was like, oh, we're starting this way. Okay. This is why I didn't watch it when I was 10, you know, it would have been kind of a rough opening. So,
right.
All right, so Nicholas, you said you've seen it since watching it the first time. Do you remember? Has it been a long time?
It's been a long time since I've watched it. And when I watched it again yesterday, there were, most of it I remember, there were definitely parts where I'm like, did I watch this movie? but, you know, there were just, and there are things that I think I picked up now that I didn't pick up then.
I'm sure. Yeah.
And we'll when we get closer to those sections, I'll get to that. But
okay.
But yeah, it's just, you know, you said, you know, when he got shot like that, it came out of the blue. Like they had given us like one brief sentence like 10 minutes before.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, so there was some inconsistencies and some very like, you can tell the difference in movie making from 84 to now.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about you, Ben? Has it been a while for you?
Yeah, I had not seen it in a long time. I didn't really remember. I just remembered the basic gist of the story and very little of the details. So I watched it last weekend with one of my sons was home from college, and he is a huge baseball fan, and he had never seen it.
Okay.
And I was like, all right, well, we're watching this together. So we sat down, and he thought it was slow at first.
Yeah.
You know, he was kind of glancing at his phone, you know, texting with people. And then as it went on, he stopped doing so much of that and started enjoying it. At the end, he said, okay, that was good. Like he liked it.
It is kind of a slow starter. It has a lot at the beginning that's important. But it even, I think the middle kind of drags. Like you have that beginning where him as a young kid, and then you see him strike out the whammer, which I'm assuming is supposed to be somewhat like Babe Ruth. Yeah, very, very similar. And then the shot, you know, then he gets shot. And then it's like 16 years later, I'm like, okay, we're not going to see any of his recovery, nothing, which of course makes it more, supposedly make it more mysterious. But like that, there's a huge lag, like from that point until, like I'd say like the next like 20 or 30 minutes seems to really drag until it really kind of picks back up again. But
the one thing, the in between when he was a child and like his, you know, before his father dies and when, you know, he's striking out, who is clearly Babe Ruth. I mean, they made the actor to even kind of look like Babe Ruth. And then he gets shot, and that time, you know, they're like, they said like he's 19. Come on, like
19-year-old with crow's feet, and
right.
Like just right. Couldn't he? Like, I mean, granted, I know that the movie technology wasn't there then, but like,
right?
Hire a kid, like hire a teenager, and then bring in, and then bring Paul Newman in.
Yeah, and Glenn Close didn't look any younger either, as you know, supposed to be 19. They're both supposed to be 19.
In the unlikely event they actually remade this movie, I think you would have three different men or three different people playing Roy Hobbs, not.
I noticed that Robert Redford was doing, like, in those early scenes, though, like, he was walking on the train tracks like a kid would and stuff like that. It was just, it was a little bit comical to watch him.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, this, I think he was 48.
47 or 48, yeah.
Yeah. And he's, like, trying to pretend he's a teenager.
I can appreciate that they did wide shots. There wasn't anything close up. And even when they met at night, you know, it's kind of, they're more like silhouettes. So they tried their best to not really reveal their age, but come on, people going to see this movie knew it was Robert Redford and knew that he wasn't 19 and couldn't pass for 19. So
I've done a couple teen comedies with you where they've gotten some, like, you know, 20, 25 year olds playing 16, 17 year olds.
Right.
But at least they almost pull it off. This one was.
Yeah. It was a stretch.
Right.
I kind of, on the other hand, I had a little bit of nostalgia, like watching a movie where they just sort of relied on the actor, you know, walking on the train tracks and you know, other kinds of ways of communicating that it was supposed to, this is a younger version of the character. Rather than the de-aging CGI stuff that we have now, which I've never seen it. You know, it's always just like almost, if it's really good, it's almost convincing.
So even the best special effects have their flaws for sure.
Right.
All right. Well, let's jump into story origin and pre-production. So as we talked about, it's based on the novel. Malcolm Kahn and Robert Bean acquired the rights to Bernard Malamud's 1952 novel, The Natural, in 1976. Phil Dusenberry was the first to write the screenplay. However, in October of 1981, Roger Towne, a Columbia Pictures story editor and brother of Robert Towne, quit to produce and write the screenplay, with Bean set to direct and Kahn co-producing. In 1983, TriStar Pictures acquired the rights to the film adaptation, which was their first production. Robert Redford was set to play the lead role in the movie, which was his first acting role in 3 years. The producers of the film mentioned the DVD extras that the movie was not intended to be a literal adaptation of the novel. Instead, it was simply, quote-unquote, based on the novel. Malamud's daughter said in one of the DVD extras that her father had seen the film and that he said it legitimized him as a writer, even though they took a lot of liberties with his book. So let's talk about some of the key differences between the novel and the film. So the movie introduces some additional characters and subplots not found in the novel, including Max Mercy, a sports journalist, and Pop Fisher's niece, Iris, who becomes romantically involved with Roy, which I thought was interesting that she wasn't part of the book. I thought she's had a pretty big, well, not a big role, but a significant role in the movie version. In the novel, Roy's romantic relationships are more complex and nuanced. His relationship with Mimo Paris, for example, is more dysfunctional and tragic compared to the more romanticized version in the movie. The novel delves deeper into Roy's internal struggles and moral dilemmas, providing more insight into his character. The movie instead focuses more on the baseball action and romance, simplifying Roy's character. And from what I was kind of reading other articles. I didn't put it all in my notes, but I know a lot of things that I read about the novel was he wasn't a very sympathetic character. Like he's not, like they said, the film version really makes him as this kind of Superman, you know, clean cut, you know, always does the right thing. And the novel version, he is not that at all. Like he's a womanizer. He doesn't treat people very nice. Which gets to the ending. So the ending is the most significant difference. In the novel, Roy actually strikes out at the end of the final game, symbolizing his failure to achieve his dreams. In the movie, however, Roy hits a game-winning home run, giving the story a more triumphant and Hollywood-style conclusion. And they said that in the book, it is kind of a downer that he strikes out, which kind of he never, you know, achieved, you know, what he was set out to do. But because his character was so flawed in the book, it was kind of like that's what he gets. The way he lived his life, he doesn't deserve to hit the home run. So there's some people a lot of people prefer the movie over the book. And there's some people that like the book because it could be more of a truer account or a more realistic story than what the movie gives us.
I did read that several people were like, this is one of the rare instances where the movie's actually better than the book.
Yeah, I saw that a couple times.
So it didn't make me want to go out and read the book.
Yeah. No. Most of what I read about the book was like, yeah, it's probably not one that I'm going to pick up and read.
Yeah, it sounds like they basically turned it into a crowd pleaser. I mean, mm-hmm. like you said, it's sort of inspired by the book, but they wanted to get people into the theaters and mm-hmm. wanted them to leave happy.
Right. I mean,
it was one thing to do it with the Bad News Bears where you had kind of a downer ending, but it made sense for the movie. I think if you had made me invest over 2 hours into this movie and ended it with him striking out, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know even know if we'd be talking about this
right movie right now. We wouldn't be sitting here right now talking about it.
Right, yeah. Right. Exactly. I don't even know if that ending would work today. Like it would definitely be an independent, more of an indie type film and not a major studio release. Studio wouldn't take a gamble on that for sure. The book version or the novel is actually somewhat based on the story of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table's quest for the Holy Grail. In the story, Roy is the protagonist whose name means king, and he wields his bat, Wonder Boy, which he takes from an oak tree struck by lightning, similar to Arthur pulling the sword from the stone. Pop Fisher, the coach, is the wounded Fisher King, although in this story, it's Roy who is wounded and cannot heal. The Lady Without Mercy is also present in the story and causes Hobbs's wound. Roy rallies around his Knights of the Round Table to be the best in the land. The original Malamud story has a tragic ending that better reflects the Arthur tale. So I thought that was, definitely see those references even in the movie.
Yeah, I think actually those kind of, I think I made those connections even when I was younger.
That okay.
It yeah. was sort of a King Arthur kind of mm-hmm. thing. It reminded me that the bat sort of reminded me of Sword in the Stone. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think I picked up on that. Now, I hadn't thought about that until you mentioned it. But it kind of rang a bell for me that kind of hit me even mm-hmm. Watching it as a kid.
I feel stupid then because I didn't pick up on it.
That's okay. Yeah. I mean, so that's that one. So then the movie, the screenwriter decided to take a different spin or lean heavier into something else. So the movie is, the storyline has been altered to make it more uplifting. The characters and symbols in the movie are heavily influenced by the writings of Homer in Greek mythology. For instance, Roy Hobbs, the main character, can be compared to Odysseus, am I saying it right? As he is trying to find his way home. Max Mercy is like Vulcan, the god of fire and forging, as he can make or break a person's career in sports. Pop Fisher represents Zeus, the king of the gods. His uniform number is actually a number one. The oak tree and lightning bolt, like the Wonder Boy bat, are symbols that represent him. The judge character is like Hades, the god of the underworld, as he is always in the dark and is responsible for judging the dead. Memo Paris can be compared to Calypso, a sea nymph who once had an affair with Odysseus and kept him from returning home. Gus Sands is like Cyclops, as he has one strange eye. Iris Gaines can be compared to Penelope, wife of Odysseus, and Roy's true love, from whom he was separated for 16 years while she raised their son. Lastly, when Roy states his goal is for the people to say, "There goes Roy Hobbs, the best there ever was in the game," this is an example of hubris, which is the Greeks considered to be excessive pride in oneself and for which a person would often suffer turmoil.
Okay, now that I did not pick up on.
Yeah.
I didn't pick up on it either, but that makes more sense to me. Like, I see it.
Yeah.
Like, I definitely saw, like, the way things happened and the way they unfolded. It was definitely more a fairy tale than it was, you know.
Yeah.
I picked up on that, but like I missed out on the Arthur thing altogether.
Yeah, yeah. I did read one person's revisiting the movie, and he was very critical of the movie, and his mainly because his criticisms were the movie didn't know what it wanted to be. Like, it wanted to be this uplifting movie, but you really weren't sure where the, like, and which I can understand it from the beginning. You're not sure what type of story it's trying to tell. Is it a tragedy that he's trying to overcome? Is it a hero's journey? You know, is it a mythological tale? So it kind of mixes all these things together, but it doesn't really have a clear cut story. And I think that's why I think it kind of fell short for me, because I didn't care enough about Roy. Like, I wanted to, but because I think maybe because there wasn't enough of his backstory and to see how he recovered, it's just like he got shot, and then nothing happened. He just pops back up. And even when he's going and telling his story to Glenn Close, like, they even kind of like brushed over that, where you really didn't hear him give any details of the struggle he had. So there was nothing to really connect me emotionally with him as a character. Just, he was just a middle-aged guy who was a rookie. That was a natural, like, he has his slump, but everybody has a slump. Like, there wasn't, I felt the tragedy of him being shot, I was expecting that more and towards, you know, the middle or towards the end of the movie instead of right out the gate. And then because it happens there, it almost gets kind of swept under the rug and everybody's like, "What happened to you?" He never explains. I don't know why he wouldn't tell people. Like, there was just those little kind of plot holes and gaps in the story really didn't.
Yeah. I feel like it definitely is a product of its time.
Oh, for sure.
I feel like if you tried to make this movie now, like, I've already broached the idea of a remake, but if they would almost have to either do two movies or do a series, because there's so much that gets left out that, like, if you make this movie now, I think people would just pick it apart because there's just so many gaps,
you know,
and to do a 2-hour movie the way they did there, like, you have to clean up a lot of holes.
Yeah. Now I'm saying that, but I'm also saying I enjoyed it. Like, it's still, overall, it was a good movie. I think it fell short of what I was expecting, because it's people talk about it being like the best baseball movie of the 80s. And it's one of the last ones I've covered. I've already done Major League. I've done Field of Dreams, but those are movies that I saw as a kid that I have a lot of nostalgia for. I watched 8 Men Out last year. We haven't covered it on the podcast yet, and that's a really good one as well.
Yeah,
so
it is.
I think you've done at least 3 80s baseball movies that are way better than this one. So
and I did Bull Durham too. So yeah, I've covered, those would be like my top 3 80s baseball movies for sure. But
it's definitely very, it's almost like an impressionistic painting or something. It's just like big brush strokes, but no real detail. But I see it compared a lot to Hoosiers which is a baseball movie.
Basketball movie, yeah.
But it's basketball, but I you know, read a quote, you know, somebody saying Hoosiers and The Natural are the two best sports movies, and if anybody disagrees, blah blah blah, you know.
Right.
But I do disagree. Hoosiers, on the other hand, I think is, I mean, I love Hoosiers, and that really was a much more, that's a much more emotionally engaging movie for me.
Yeah, more compelling
than The Natural was. Yeah.
And that's one I haven't, I need to rewatch because I haven't watched that one in a long time. But yeah, I remember really liking Hoosiers though when I saw that one.
I'll pretend I've seen it so I can join this conversation.
And now these messages.
What seems to be the problem, pal?
There's just so much pain in the world, so many issues. I don't think I can bear it.
Well, friendo, it sounds like you could use a dose of Pop Culture Roulette.
Pop Culture Roulette? What's that? Some sort of pop culture-themed podcast or something?
That's right, sonny boy. When hope seems far, dive into some PCR.
But I already get my entertainment news from Variety.
Huh, that's pretty good. If you're a chucklehead, PCR gives you news you need. Condensed, unfiltered, and raw. From three nerds who know a little something about something.
Wow, okay. Sign me up.
That's the spirit. Pop Culture Roulette. New episodes every Monday. Available on all major podcast directories.
All right, well, let's do a brief talk about Barry Levinson, the director. Of course, he's a name that I recognize. I've seen several of his movies, but just in case you're not familiar with him, after some success as a screenwriter, notably the Mel Brooks comedy Silent Movie in 1976 and High Anxiety in 77, his first directorial effort was Diner in 1982, for which he also wrote the script and earned him an Oscar nomination for Best Original Screenplay. Diner was the first of four films set in the Baltimore of Levinson's youth. The other three were 10 Men in 87, a story of aluminum siding salesman in the 60s starring Richard Dreyfuss and Danny DeVito, the immigrant family saga Avalon in 1990 featuring Elijah Wood in one of his earliest screen appearances, and Liberty Heights in 1999. His biggest hit, both critically and financially, was Rain Man in 88, which we've covered already, starring Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise. The film won four Academy Awards, including Best Director and Best Picture. He also directed the classic war comedy Good Morning Vietnam in 87, starring Robin Williams, and he later collaborated with Williams on the fantasy film Toys in 1992 and the political comedy Man of the Year in 2006. He also directed the critically acclaimed historical crime drama Bugsy in 1991, which starred Warren Beatty and was also nominated for 10 Academy Awards. A well-honored director, but I definitely know Rain Man and Good Morning Vietnam are two movies I've seen a million times. And big fan of both of those movies. Any of those you guys fans of, or was he like, when you think of the 80s, is Barry Levinson a name that you would think of?
Oh yeah, for sure. Like you said, Good Morning Vietnam. That was one of my favorite movies in the 80s and, or at the time, at least. I haven't seen it a lot since then, but I remembered going into this. I remembered, you know, his name and a lot of the movies that he did, and that I really did enjoy a lot of his work over the years. So
it's definitely a name I know. I like you guys. I love Good Morning Vietnam. There's a lot of other movies, but yeah, Rain Man I've seen, I've enjoyed. I mean, just looking through his list. I mean, I've seen a lot of what he's done and some of it I can take or leave, but he's definitely done a lot of really, you know, quality stuff, producing or directing. I mean, obviously he's won at least one best director. So,
Right. All right. Well, let's jump into casting. There are a lot of people in this movie that I didn't realize were in this movie until I started watching it. And there's like a few that popped up. Like, I didn't even know that they were acting. Like, we'll get to that towards the end. But of course, we'll start with the star. Robert Redford is Roy Hobbs. Redford's television career began in 1960, including an appearance on Alfred Hitchcock Presents in 1961 and The Twilight Zone in 1962. His greatest Broadway success was as a stuffy newlywed husband in Neil Simon's Barefoot in the Park. Redford made his film debut in War Hunt in 1962. He gained success as a leading man in films such as Barefoot in the Park, 67, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid in 69, Jeremiah Johnson in 72, and The Candidate in 72. He received a nomination for the Academy Award for Best Actor for his performance in the crime caper The Sting in 73. He continued to star in films such as The Way We Were in 73, All the President's Men in 76, and The Electric Horseman in 1979. So I think that's probably another reason why this one didn't really appeal to me, because Redford being much more of a 70s actor, more so than an 80s actor, I guess, for when I was a kid, maybe why it didn't really jump out at me. But his 80s movies include Brubaker, The Natural, as we talked about, we're talking about now, Out of Africa in 85. He also directed A River Runs Through It in 1992 and Quiz Show in 1995. Anything else to add about Mr. Redford?
What is there to talk about a guy like that? So, I mean, it's just, he's done a lot, and it would be hard to cover him in just a couple minutes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I skipped over a lot of stuff for sure.
I did really like the, it's the last movie I think I saw him in. I'm looking at his IMDb right now, trying to, I can't remember the name of it. He was on there was almost no dialogue in it. He was just on a boat.
Is that All Is Lost?
Yes.
I think 2013, yeah.
Yeah, which in some ways kind of reminded me of this, or this movie, I think kind of reminded me of that a little bit. And just the fact, I mean, obviously this has a lot of dialogue and stuff, but it had that same kind of, almost like it's a fable or a parable or something that isn't maybe quite so literal. That's what reminded me of it.
Yeah. So the two eras of the film show Roy Hobbs at age 19 and age 35, where Redford was 47 at the time of filming. So, too old for both settings.
Yeah, but at least at 35, I kind of bought that one.
Yeah,
I mean, it was still
47-year-old Robert Redford is not. It's not. He's got a little something on us. Yeah. I think genetically.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he was in good shape. And I think there were some people that said that he was one of the few actors that actually looked like he could play ball. Like he looked like a ball player. All right, moving down the list, one of my favorite actors of all time, Robert Duvall as Max Mercy. Duvall made his acting debut portraying Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird in 1962. Other early roles included Captain Newman, M.D. in 63, Bullet in 68, True Grit in 69, MASH in 1970, Joe Kidd in 72. He won an Academy Award for Best Actor for his role in the film Tender Mercies in 83. His other Oscar-nominated films include The Godfather in 72, Apocalypse Now in 79, The Great Santini in 79, The Apostle in 97, A Civil Action in 98, The Judge in 2014. Other notable roles include, I mean, the list goes on and on, Godfather Part II, The Conversation, Network, Days of Thunder, Falling Down, The Paper, The Scarlet Letter, Sling Blade, Open Range, Four Christmases, Crazy Heart, Get Low, Jack Reacher, and Widows, and A Partridge in a Pear Tree.
I mean, you named a lot of classics there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I was a little bit surprised he agreed to do this movie, because he's not even really in it that much.
Yeah.
And doesn't his character? Small. It doesn't really. You know, just has a few interactions with Roy, and I was kind of surprised that he was interested in doing a part like that. But
yeah,
he was good in the role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's definitely one of those actors. Like when I see him in a movie, I automatically know the movie's going to be better because he's in it. Like he adds such a gravitas to his whatever character he's playing, even if it's small like this one. Like he gives it his all, and so I really, you know, Days of Thunder isn't a great movie, but he's great in it. You know,
right?
I like Days of Thunder, but anyway,
I can't think of anybody off the top of my head that we've talked about in the past, but I know what said it. Like generally speaking, he's not the problem with the movie.
right.
Like yeah. Like he might be in bad movies, but generally speaking, he's not the reason.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We had that discussion with Kevin Bacon in our episode about Footloose. Is like, he's made some not so great movies, but it wasn't because of him. It's just the writing or the directing wasn't great, but he's always really good in it, even if he's a little over the top. But that's talking about Kevin Bacon, not Robert Duvall. But is there a favorite of yours, Robert Duvall movie?
You named so many classics there. It's hard to say.
Yeah, nothing comes to mind. I just, you know, I'm trying to remember. I just, he's been in so much. It's hard to nail down. Like
a lot of those, he's like a supporting character. So it's not like he doesn't get the lead very often, but even as a supporting character, he's really good. All right, we'll move along. Glenn Close as Iris Gaines. She received a lot of Academy Award nominees and winners in this cast. She received 8 Academy Award nominations for her roles in The World According to Garp in 82, The Big Chill in 83, this movie, The Natural in 84, Fatal Attraction in 87, Dangerous Liaisons in 88, Albert Nobbs in 2011, The Wife in 2017, and Hillbilly Elegy in 2020. She has also starred in Jagged Edge in 85, Reversal of Fortune in 90, Hamlet in 90, The House of the Spirits in 93, The Paper in 94, Mars Attacks 96, and Air Force One in 97. And of course, she also portrayed Cruella de Vil in 101 Dalmatians in 96 and its sequel 102 Dalmatians in 2000. And what I love about both Glenn Close and Robert Duvall is they're good in comedies as well. Like, I love Robert Duvall in Four Christmases, and to know that they put Mars Attacks on Glenn Close's, you know, filmography, like, she needs to be known for Mars Attacks. So that's a crazy movie.
She was the first lady in that, right?
I think when, so. When it's been a long time since I've seen that one. Yeah.
It's just nice to see people like Duvall and Glenn Close not take themselves so seriously.
Right, right.
And be right. willing to do a movie like Mars Attacks. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, I love Mars Attacks, but it's so full of just ridiculous things. But people like Glenn Close and Jack Nicholson make that movie more legitimate than it probably should have been.
Yeah, they got a chance to just ham it up for the sake of being funny and not worried about trying to win awards and stuff. So I think they need that kind of creative release sometimes just to do something, you know, lighthearted and fun. All right, and then we'll move along to Kim Basinger as Memo Paris. And a lot of these we talked about in other episodes as well. So we talked about Kim Basinger in our Batman episode because that's probably what she's the most known for. But she began her career as a model and switched to acting in 1976. She appeared in several television productions, including a remake of From Here to Eternity in 1979 before making her featured debut in the rural drama, that's the hardest word to say in the English language, rural drama Hard Country in 1981. Hailed as a sex symbol in the 80s and 90s, she first gained widespread attention for her performance in the James Bond movie Never Say Never Again in 1983. She went on to receive a Golden Globe nomination for her role in The Natural. Her other films include No Mercy in 86, Blind Date in 87, My Stepmother's an Alien in 88, Cool World in 92, The Real McCoy in 93, 8 Mile in 2002, Grudge Match in 2013. I skipped over a lot there as well, but
yeah, the one she won an Oscar for, L.A. Confidential.
Yeah, L.A. Confidential.
Yeah,
yep.
I was thinking the same thing. Like, that was a great movie.
Yeah. Another one that's done serious and comedies, you know, Stepmother's an Alien still makes me laugh. I don't think I've ever seen that movie all the way through, but the title always makes me laugh. But moving right along, Wilford Brimley as Pop Fisher. We talked about Wilford Brimley in our episode of The Thing, so I won't go over his filmography too extensively. But one thing I did mention there that I got ridiculed for, so I'll mention it here. He frequently appeared in commercials, including a series of commercials for Quaker Oats, a campaign which became famous for repeating the slogan, "It's the right thing to do." He also appeared in numerous television advertisements for Liberty Medical, a company specializing in home delivery of medical products, including diabetes testing supplies. He appeared in commercials for the American Diabetes Association and was the voiceover for Brian Foods television commercial campaign. So, because I think it was the way he said diabetes.
Diabetes.
That's it. It's like I knew I was going to mess it up, but yes. Diabetes. But yeah. I love Wilford Brimley. Anything he's in, he's great. Cocoon, probably one of his most well-known. And he was on the TV show Our House in the 80s as well.
Cocoon was the first one that came to mind for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that was where I guess maybe I'd seen him in Quaker Oats commercials before that. Yeah. I don't know. But I think that was when I first sort of remember seeing him in a film.
And then probably the biggest name with the smallest amount of time on screen, Barbara Hershey as Harriet Byrd. The versatile actress was first discovered by a talent agent when she was attending Hollywood High School, and she began working in television. She made movies in the 80s such as The Stuntman, The Entity, The Right Stuff, Hannah and Her Sisters. She was in Hoosiers, which we talked about already, Ten mm-hmm. Men, Shy People, A World Apart, and Beaches with Bette Midler in 1988, which we've covered on the podcast as well. But yeah. Yeah, what you thought about, she's the person that shoots Roy Hobbs early on in the film, and that's really about all she does in the movie. She sits on a train and looks at him, and then 5 minutes later, she shoots him.
So, right.
When I saw her name in the credits, I expected her to be in the movie more, but she really wasn't.
With the helpful little foreshadowing from Robert Duvall reading the newspaper. Oh, somebody's going around shooting athletes.
Yeah.
Wonder if that's going to be important in about 5 minutes.
Yeah. Right. At least there was a payoff to that line.
Was she, so had she done much before this? Because again, it was a pretty small,
yeah,
small part, and she wasn't in it for very long.
So the ones here, the stuntman in 80, the entity in 82, probably lesser known. She had done the right stuff in 83. So she's probably coming off of that being a pretty big movie in 83.
My guess is that when you put Redford and Barry Levinson, you probably had a lot of these people just, well, you know,
wanting to work with them. Yeah.
Having their name associated with that.
Yeah. I was thinking about that when you mentioned, Ben, about why, you know, Robert Duvall wanted to be in this movie being such a small part, but to work with Redford, you know, I think was probably something he wanted to do. For sure.
Like you said, it was the first movie Redford had made in 3 years. So
yeah. Yes.
They people weren't getting a lot of chances to work with Redford back then, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Good point.
All right. So I got a few more here and then we'll be done. Robert Prosky as the judge. He became a well-known supporting actor in the 80s with his roles in Thief in 81, Christine in 83, and Broadcast News in 87. His most notable movies include Gremlins 2, The New Batch in 1990, Hoffa in 92, Mrs. Doubtfire in 93, Last Action Hero in 93, Rudy in 93, Miracle on 34th Street remake in 1994, Dead Man Walking in 95, and Mad City in 1997. His most notable television role was Sergeant Stan Jablonski on the TV police drama Hill Street Blues. He was definitely someone that I recognized.
Yeah, I couldn't have named any of those other things he was in, but he's one of those guys. He's like, oh yeah, I know who that is. I've seen him before.
Yeah, as Nicholas and I have called him many times, he's the that guy of this movie.
Yep.
Yeah, there's that guy. Like, I mean, even when I saw him today, I would not have told you his name was Robert Prosky. I will never, hopefully that's never a name on a game show that I'll have to remember for the $20,000 question, because I will never get it right. But even though I've mentioned him on episodes of the podcast, I'm sure. All right, so then we've got Joe Don Baker as the Whammer. He got himself noticed playing Steve McQueen's younger brother and Junior Bonner in 72, then scored the lead role in the unexpected hit Walking Tall in 1973. His next few films were rather forgettable until he landed a role of police detective Earl Itchside in To Kill a Cop in 1978, which led to him reprising the same character in the short-lived TV series. He also adapted to taking on comedy roles, as well as picking up plenty of work playing lawmen, military men, and politicians, in films like Fletch in 85, The Living Daylights in 87, once again, Mars Attacks in 96, and his intelligence operative Jack Wade in the 007 films Tomorrow Never Dies and GoldenEye in the 90s. Yep, good old Joe Don Baker.
Yeah, he's another one of those kind of that guy. He's like, oh, look at that, it's Joe Don Baker.
Yeah, when he showed up on the movie, like I don't remember his name showing in the credits, or I missed it when it came up. But I was looking, I'm like, I know who this person is. Like, I just could not think of his name for anything. And I was getting him mixed up with Fred Thompson, who the senator, like that has been in the movie, especially more so in the 90s or late 80s. But I was like, that's not him. Like, it's somebody else. And then when I saw it was Joe Don Baker, I was like, oh yeah, from Fletch. So that's he was the policeman or the police chief, I think.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So hey, you and Tommy Lasorda. I hate Tommy Lasorda.
Yeah.
I don't know what the rights to using the name Babe Ruth would have been in 1985, 86, 84?
84, yeah.
But they might as well just call him Babe Ruth instead of the Whammer. I mean, other than the fact, I mean, I would say they didn't use anything real, but they used the Pirates and the Cubs, so I don't know.
That's what I was about to say, is that, like, it was confusing to have a fictional New York team, but then they're playing real teams.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I even thought, I was like, were the Yankees ever the Knights? Like, I don't remember that any kind of baseball history I've ever looked
like
at.
Like I said, my son is super into baseball. He's a walking encyclopedia, and I had to ask him. I was like, was there ever a team in New York called the Knights? He was like, no.
So. Right. And then we've got Darren McGavin as Gus Sands, who was actually uncredited in his role. We'll talk about that here in a second, but McGavin portrayed the title character Mickey Spillane's Mike Hammer from 1958 to 1959, starred in Riverboat in 59 to 61, and Kolchak the Night Stalker in 74 to 75. His film credits include No Deposit, No Return in 76, Airport 77 in 77, A Christmas Story in 83, of course, his most famous for sure. And Billy Madison in 1995. He'll always be the dad in Christmas Story, no matter what he's in.
Yeah.
While he had a major supporting role as the bookmaker Gus Sands, he received no credit in the recent retrospective documentary on the special edition DVD of the movie. Robert Prosky, who played the judge, claimed McGavin was cast late in the picture when having received a lesser billing than the other stars. Thus, McGavin chose to go uncredited. Prosky noted that Gavin wound up drawing more attention to himself as a result. So by him saying, you know, he probably did interview say I was uncredited, or he mentioned it enough to where he got more credit by being uncredited. But yeah, thought that was interesting. He wasn't credited. When I saw that earlier before I really was, I was trying not to do any research before I watched the movie, but I was looking at a few things before it started. And I noticed that he was uncredited and kind of saw that story. And I was like, I thought he would like a really, really small part, but he had a pretty significant role in the movie.
So. Yeah. Like he was in the movie more than Glenn Close, and Glenn Close got an Oscar nomination.
Right.
So.
Right. Exactly. And then the one person that I did not expect to see in this movie was Michael Madsen as Bartholomew Bump Bailey. When he came on the screen, I was like, he was acting in 1984.
Right. Yeah. I was surprised too.
And also, apparently, he always looked that way.
Right.
Like, yeah, he looked about like he looked in Reservoir Dogs, and that was
92.
Like 10 years. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like
eight years later, I guess.
Right, right. So, yeah, he's done frequent collaborations with Quentin Tarantino, Reservoir Dogs in 92, Kill Bill Volume 2 in 2004, and The Hateful Eight in 2015, as well as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood in 2019. He's also known for films such as The Doors in 91, Thelma and Louise in 91, Free Willy in 93, Species in 95, Donnie Brasco in 97, Die Another Day in 2002, and Sin City in 2005. And once again, it's a movie, but did anybody else expect him to die from running into the board in the, and like, I thought he was going to get injured. I didn't expect him to die. Like, that was a little shocking for me in the movie. Was I the only one?
No, that was one of my notes. I was like, when they ran through the fence, I was like, oh, that's the injury that's going to put,
Roy.
Right.
Roy in the game. Roy in the game.
And then they're like, and he died.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
I guess, anyway, you know, it was 1939 or whatever.
Yeah. So,
you know.
Yeah.
And then they spread his ashes over the stadium with a flyby. And you're like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
That doesn't, wait, what? What?
That doesn't seem very sanitary. I don't think I want anybody onto me from, you know, above.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that made no sense. But yeah, it was like he ran through the fence and then they were like, and he died. What?
Yeah. It's like I want a little footnote. And this is why we have padding in stadiums now. Like, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think they said it like a few minutes later, like they made a comment about, you know, he hit his head, or the way he hit was what caused him to die or whatever. But yeah, that was,
it
that
just
was
didn't look talking. Like, yeah, I mean, when it happened, it didn't look, it that didn't bad. Look like, yeah. Right. Right. Yeah.
We'd seen enough cartoons in the '80s to know that, you know, even the coyote can run through a wall and still survive. So surely the outfield would be okay. But
yeah. The outfield wall didn't even have a fake tunnel painted on it.
Right. Right. Oh man. All right, so a couple of cameos. Director Barry Levinson did the uncredited voice of the Knights radio play-by-play. According to Levinson, he had intended to have a professional broadcaster do the role, but didn't have proper time during post-production to find someone for the part. So he ended up doing it himself, which I thought was a cool little nod there. It's decent. And then the piano player at the party where Roy Hobbs becomes ill and had to be taken to the hospital was Randy Newman, the composer of the film's music. Now, most people will talk about the soundtrack of this movie being what, you know, said was one of the highlights of the movie. And I will say it's beautifully shot. Like, it's a beautiful looking movie, mm-hmm. and the soundtrack is phenomenal. So I will give it, that does elevate it, I think, a lot. Even with the story lets us down, I think the soundtrack and the cinematography really elevate it.
Yeah. A couple things about the music. One, I didn't realize it was Randy Newman until mm-hmm. I watched it this time. Mm-hmm. And also the night before I watched The Natural, I happened to watch an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia that ended with The Natural. They used The Natural music.
Wow.
because they go out and they you know play baseball and they use the Natural music and basically did a parody of the end of the Natural.
Oh, okay.
And then it was totally coincidental though that I watched it the night before. But yeah, that music is. I told my son, I was like, you'll recognize the music.
Yeah, they've used it a lot in different. Yeah. As I was playing, I was like, I've heard this. I'm sure in like sports. Any kind of sports montage or kind of a highlights thing that they've done over the years. I'm sure that I've heard that and didn't know that was from The Natural, but yeah.
Yeah. Randy Newman is still raking in the royalties checks. Is he still alive?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's still, now he's doing a lot of the Pixar stuff, but you know, he's still, you know, Mr. Win Oscars every couple years.
Yeah. Yeah. They throw an original song every now and then to get him a few more bucks. Few more awards, but yeah, multi-talented, that's for sure.
Yeah, he really hates short people.
All right, well, let's talk about iconic scenes, favorite scenes. I think we can all agree the most iconic scene is the final home run, busting the lights at the stadium, and as it, you know, which I thought this can't be safe with all the.
Well, they had them wired all together so that when one broke, they all just started showering sparks on everyone.
Right, right.
In a world where you feel yourself running through the outfield wall, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
The lights do seem quite questionable. Yeah. I mean, that's also so parodied.
The
Simpsons have done it. I mean, you name it, the Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Like, I mean, I think that moment is probably what keeps The Natural in the conversation because it's such an iconic, like, you know, bottom of the ninth, you know, you're down by a run, you're down two strikes. And, you know, I mean, it's why the Kirk Gibson home run from the Dodgers World Series in the 80s is, I mean, Kirk Gibson is, you know, almost dead. And he hits a home run to win the World Series. You know, the same. I mean, obviously, this wasn't to win the World Series. It was just to get in the playoffs, and we have no idea what happened.
Right.
But, you know.
Well, surely that was his last game. He was bleeding. Yeah. You know, well, which, you know, I was like, I was honestly, you know, once again, we've seen too many newer movies. I was expecting him to cross home plate and then just die. Like, it was like, this is the end of his story. Like, he hit his home run. You know, he saved the, you know, Pop from losing the team or losing his job or whatever, the whole blackmail thing that the judge had him on. He would cross home plate and just collapse, and that would be his legacy that he won. And instead, we get a 30-second shot of him throwing the ball with his son, I guess, a few months later that he retired from baseball. But
well, I think this is another example of something that, like, if without that ending, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about
for
the
movie. Yeah, like, for sure.
The movie was, you know, I was interested. It was pretty good up until that point. But I really think, like, the reason that people loved it at the time and walked out of the theater feeling great and telling other people they had to go see it was basically just because of that last five minutes and just ending on that high. Hoosiers, like, had a lot more, you know, kind of hit me in the feels, as the kids say these days.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But, like, the only time The Natural really did that is at the end.
Yeah. I'll agree with that. And I was going to say, like, credit to Barry Levinson that he crafted that ending so well.
Yeah.
Editing and just the, I mean, it's put together so well. Like, it, like I said, there were, yeah, I was kind of like your son. I was a couple times I was trying to keep myself from picking up my phone or like doing other things. Like, no, I got to watch this movie. But once I got to that part, I was like, I was dialed in. Like, I didn't want to miss anything, even though I knew what was going to happen. I've seen that final shot, you know, a million times before. But just to see how he built it up, it really was well done. Very well done.
One of the things that I'd written down was the scene earlier in the movie where he hits a home run and he breaks the clock.
Yeah.
So I wonder, like, part of me was wondering this time, does having two of the all very similar moments in the movie, does it kind of take away a little bit from the end? Or does, I mean, because you almost, like, I had completely forgot in the rewatch that he had broken the clock, because I remember the end, like, when the lights were shattered. And so it was like, so I don't know if maybe because the lights were shattered and the electric explosions and the rounding the bases, like, It was such a bigger moment. Like, you kind of forget that he had already done a big breaking of stuff.
Yeah. I think it, if for a first time watch, like, of course I knew the big one at the end when he hit the clock, thinking of it from a first time watcher, like back in 84, I think it kind of elevated it. It's like the clock was big, but for him to hit the lights and the explosion of lights was almost bigger. Like, it was like he didn't just hit the home run, like he hit it further and harder than even when he broke the clock. So that's kind of the way I interpreted it.
Yeah, I think maybe the clock scene is in there just to sort of establish, like, this is something this guy can do.
Right.
Like, he can hit it way out, you know, and he can break things in the process.
I do like the scene after he's been in the hospital, after he's trying to recover and he's on the field, and Max Mercy's there trying to take pictures, and he hits the ball right where Max is. I'm like, okay, you got some serious accuracy if you can, because he hits it a couple of times, right at him. So, which I thought was a good little scene that he knew exactly where to put the ball. The baseball scenes are probably some of my favorite. Like, I love good action scenes in a sports movie, the actual gameplay. But them being so bad at the beginning, I was like, come on, guys. I mean, the team, they were so terrible. And it's like, it's funny in movies like, Major League, but like at this time, this was professional ball players. Like, you would think they'd be a little bit better than they wouldn't be making those kind of mistakes. But, I know it's all part of the story, and it is more of a fable. That bothered me just a little bit watching.
And all they needed was Roy Hobbs to come along, and suddenly they're great players.
Yeah. You never see him like teaching them or like giving them a pep talk. No, I did like the one guy that keeps coming in and telling them, like, sick, losing is a disease like syphilis or whatever, all the different things he said or whatever. And Roy finally like walks out. I was like, good, please walk out, because I don't need to hear this guy's speech again. Like, did they really have to hear the speech after every loss? Like, that was pretty crazy.
That was their punishment for losing.
Yeah. You're going to sit in this talk one more time. Like, who is this guy? Like, is it like they had Tony Robbins speakers back in the 20s and 90s,
Not very good ones, apparently.
Not very good ones, yeah.
Yeah, let's say, I didn't know that sports psychology was a thing back in 1930.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I had one of the iconic scenes, and I think mainly because it's one that's been parodied so much, is him carving the bat.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then writing Wonder Boy in it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because Homer did it.
Yeah. What is The Simpsons not parodied? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, yeah, at this point.
They'll have to parody themselves at this point, because they parodied everything else.
They probably have.
I haven't seen a Simpsons episode in many, many years, but
I still watch every one of them. And then I also had the Whammer scene, the striking out the Whammer. Mm-hmm. Like, that was, yeah. I mean, is kind of boring as the early part of the movie was, like, that was kind of kind of edge of your seat. Like, he got one, he got two. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, I love the build up too. Like, check the, he's got something on his hands. He's like, he can't be throwing it that fast. And then the last one, he takes his jacket off and takes his hat off. Like, okay, I'm really going to hit it this time. It's like, oh, and you're over at that point. He's going to get the last one by you. So, and I like when Max Mercy backs up. He's like, why are you backing up? He's like, he could be wild. I don't know. Like, you got any other iconic scenes, Ben, or did Nicholas take them all? I think he hit the big ones for sure.
Yeah, I think we covered the big ones. I mean, yeah, it's definitely there's a lot of scenes in it that have been parodied, and watching a movie like that with my kids, I'm always, it's kind of cool to think about, like, okay, they're figuring out now.
Mm-hmm. This came from.
This is where it came from. This is where that episode of whatever that they saw.
Yeah. I understand that reference now. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Any favorite scenes you guys want to talk about?
I think I've covered everything. I mean, the only other thing on my list is not a favorite scene. So we'll
hold off on that.
Yeah. We'll hold off on that a second.
Yeah. I think I'm good too.
Yeah. The iconic scenes are good. I mean, the only other iconic scene, I think it's not as iconic as the other ones, but when Glenn Close stands up in the stands when he's going through a slump, that was pretty cool. But it's not as once again, not as impactful as I wanted it to be. Like I wanted it, like I said, hit in the feels. I didn't really get that in that scene as much as I really wanted to. But once again, going back to 1984, I'm sure though it probably hit those things, but we've seen so many other movies of this type that of course are made because this one was such a big hit. So it doesn't have the same impact seeing it now, I'm sure.
And quite honestly, by like that point, you've almost forgot that Glenn Close is even in the movie. Like,
right, right.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. The only reason you remember is because you're like, oh, that's Glenn Close. Like,
yeah.
You know, like if it had just been a random actress, like, mm-hmm. I don't know if like that would have had the impact that it did, because you'd be like, wait, who is she again? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the whole thing with like the son being Roy's. I mean, we saw that coming a mile away. I mean, that wasn't any big twist ending for anybody, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah. You just kind of had to do the math.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like my son. And then like, you know, she doesn't want to talk about it. You're like, oh yeah. Cause it's clearly his.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When did we last see each other 16 years ago?
Right.
Oh, I have a son who's 15, 8, and 3 months.
Right.
You
know. Right.
And now these messages.
Hey there, fellow 80s movie aficionados. Are you ready to embark on a nostalgia-filled journey to the greatest era of cinema? Then look no further than the Retro Life for You 80s Movie Podcast. Join us every week as we rewind the VHS tapes, dust off those Betamax classics, and dive headfirst into the neon-soaked, totally tubular world of the 1980s movies. From the Brat Pack to action heroes, we've got it all covered. Breakfast Club, Ghostbusters, E.T. and Indiana Jones, and more. It's like a trip in Doc Brown's time machine, but without the DeLorean. So whether you're a diehard 80s film buff or just curious about the cinematic gems of the past, Retro Life for You is your ticket to the ultimate movie time warp. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Retro Life for You. And we can be found anywhere you listen to your podcast, as well as on our website, www.retrolife4u.com.
All right, well, let's jump into some scenes and trivia, maybe make us think of some other scenes we can talk about. Boston Red Sox great Ted Williams' single goal while playing baseball was for people to say, "There goes the greatest hitter who ever lived," a sentiment echoed by Roy Hobbs in the movie. Like Williams, Hobbs wears number 9 on his uniform, and Williams and Hobbs both hit home runs in their last career at-bats. Hobbs was also an outfielder, as Williams was. According to Roger Engel of The New Yorker, Redford modeled his swing on Williams's and added that Redford played so authentically, you might even want to sign him up for your team. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
That's another weird coincidence. My son, one I've been talking about.
Right.
he's in Louisville today visiting my other son who is up there. And they went to the Louisville Slugger Museum.
Wow.
And he sent me a picture of a Ted Williams display.
Oh, nice.
That's in the Louisville Slugger Museum up there. So
very cool.
I didn't realize that that was modeled on him.
So. Mm-hmm. There were several parallels, like a lot of some things that they said that the there were true stories or, you know, true accounts that they took from in the story. Like there was a baseball player that was shot by a crazed fan. I thought I had that in my notes, but obviously I didn't.
There was one who actually broke a clock.
Yeah. Yep.
And if you were ever to hit it, they were going to give you a watch.
Yeah. Yep.
And then apparently it took them like 50 years to actually give the player the watch.
That was actually my next note of trivia I was going to put in, but good. You covered it. That was good.
We didn't say we'd give you the watch now.
Yeah. It was Bama Rowell of the Boston Braves doubled off the Ebbets Field scoreboard clock on May 30th, 1946. He was promised a free watch by Belova, but he had to wait until 1987 to receive it. So, yeah. Speaking of baseball bats on display, the bat that bat boy Bobby Savoy gives Roy is called the Savoy Special. The Savoy Special was a brand of beer in the 1930s and was made by the United States Brewing Company. The bat is now in the collection at the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum in Cooperstown, New York, displayed along with Roy Hobbs' jacket in an exhibit titled Baseball in the Movies.
Yeah, the Baseball Hall of Fame is something else. If you haven't had a chance to get out there, it is, it's an experience. It's just, especially for somebody who's as deeply into baseball as I am, like it is just, I mean, I don't want to use the word religious experience because that's not quite accurate, but it is, right. It's,
I mean, it's an experience. Some, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was, my father and I went up there in the early 2000s. It was something else.
Have you been before, Ben?
I haven't. Maybe I'll.
That was insane.
For one of these days. Yeah, my son has brought it up several times that he would like to go there, as along with my wife, who's also a big. That's where he gets it from. They're both big baseball fans.
All right, a road trip. Let me know when you guys are going. Mm-hmm. I'll just meet up there, and we'll do a mini episode from the because I would love to go as well. So. All right, last little trivia nugget I have. In 2001, Bill Simmons of ESPN Magazine compiled Ray Hobbs' 1939 rookie season stats, taking cues from the movie. His line would have looked something like this: 115 games played, 400 at bats, 92 runs, 140 hits, 44 home runs, 106 RBIs, a .350 batting average. Hobbs struck out 85 times and walked 75 times. Now, how he calculated all that, I don't know, but it sounds cool.
Yeah, I was watching the movie, and I was like, that's extrapolating a lot. I don't know where you got it from.
That's 2001. It was before AI, so he obviously had some kind of algorithm working for him, figuring it out.
Yeah, I guess he's factoring in the slump, Roy's slump in the middle of the movie, but...
He's probably factoring in whatever the stats were normal around that time, I guess, too. I don't know. I don't know how accurate it is, but it sounded cool. And as we've learned on this show, if you want accurate or cool, cool wins every time. Or
absolutely. You know,
logic versus cool, cool will always win. So
especially in the 80s.
Especially in the 80s. All right, box office and critical reception. The Natural was released in North American theaters on May 11th, 1984, debuting number one at the box office. The only other new release that week was the Chuck Norris and late Lou Gossett Jr. team-up action comedy Firewalker, which took the number three slot, which actually did better than I thought it would have. The Natural remained at the number one slot for the second week before being booted by Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom over the Memorial Day weekend. So... But it did stay in the top 10 for several weeks after that. So it still did pretty well. And I was looking in the box office. So like Indiana Jones won that week. And then the following week, it was beat by one of the Star Trek sequels. And then the week after that, because we had it in June, Ghostbusters and Gremlins opened the same weekend and they were one and two respectively. So it, you know, the summer of 84 was ridiculous.
It's incredible when you look back and you see like all these movies just bunched together you can't believe they all came out just within weeks of each other.
Yeah. All right. Critical reception. Rotten Tomatoes has it 83% on the tomato meter and an 88% audience score. IMDb has it 7.4 out of 10 with viewers and a 61 on Metacritic, which we always talk about Metacritic is always so much lower, but that even seems low for this movie. But what do you guys say? You think it's in the 70s, 80s out of 100? Where would you place it?
I'd probably be on the IMDb side of things. Maybe a little lower than 7.4, but not much.
What about you, Ben?
I mean, I'd give it a solid B.
I'd
give it an 85.
Okay. Yeah, I'm kind of like the upper 70s, low 80s for me. Like, I think it's definitely, you know, I'm a big rewatchability. That's where I kind of rank my stuff. I could definitely rewatch this again. It's not going to be one that I'll watch every year like I do Bull Durham and Major League and Field of Dreams. But it's a good one to pull out every couple of years. If I'm looking for like an inspirational story, you know, more of a slower paced drama, it's definitely got that appeal to it. I think it's good. I don't think it's, like I said, I don't think it's as great as it's been hyped up to be, which is, it's tough. And a movie's been hyped for 40 years. You kind of expect something and it doesn't meet it.
Right. And right. You've seen parodies of it. And you've seen the end.
Mm-hmm.
I think you said, you know, you've seen it millions of times, but you haven't seen it in context.
In context. Before, yeah.
So, right. So, yeah. I kind of had a similar, like I kind of sat down expecting it to be better than it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's there's nothing really that wrong with it, right? But it was it was a much simpler story than I thought, than I kind of remembered it being. And it was a lot of the story beats were just really pat, a lot of cliches that maybe they weren't.
Maybe they weren't
cliches in 84.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think maybe this is the movie that gave us the cliches.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah. Or at least some of them. The cinematography was, like you mentioned, was amazing. And the music is great. And, you know, all the acting is great. And,
yeah, I was going to say, the performances are solid. I mean, there's not really a bad. I don't think anybody was bad in their role. That's you know, we usually talk about somebody that really wasn't that great, but I think everybody really, you know, did really well on the movie for sure. Even Kim Basinger, but that's another story.
Well, I mean, I think Kim Basinger's role was just to prove that women are the devil.
Yeah. Yeah. That, once again, the cliche, like the, you know, she buddies up to the star to be his downfall because she's working for somebody else. So, you know, that's definitely the cliche we kind of saw coming, but enjoyable. Good movie. Definitely worth, if you haven't seen it, which why have you listened this far and not seen it, but definitely worth watching if you haven't seen it.
Yes. Far better than Jaws 3D.
Yes. Yes. Well,
that we can all agree on.
Way better. Way better. All right. Well, anything else we want to talk about The Natural before we close this episode?
I was confused by one thing.
Okay.
Well, I mean, a couple of things. One thing in particular. So Barbara Hershey.
Yes.
Is apparently going around killing men who are like the best in their field.
Right. Are going to be the best.
Are going to be the best. So they said like a football player and somebody else. I don't remember. Like it was at least two different guys. So she sees Roy Hobbs strike the whammer out because she's clearly going to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah. So
she sees this and goes, oh, well, this guy's. Why after like it seems like three, she's on a mission of some kind that they don't really bother to explain except for a throwaway line just to make sure that we know that this woman who shows up is going to do it. She just immediately throws herself out the window. Like that made no sense to me. Like she's on a mission. Like why would she just like not just be like, all right, well, that's another one down. Where's the next? You know.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. That kind of seemed weird. And it just made me think, I think as a kid, again, you know, when you see these movies as a kid, things mean different.
Oh yeah.
You pick up on other things. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, the fact that she was killing them with silver bullets, I kind of maybe thought, well, maybe they're werewolves.
Werewolves. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
They're the best at this sport. They must be a werewolf.
Right. Yeah. So really, Barbara Hershey's character is the hero of the story. She's going around killing werewolves.
They really didn't. Like, there's this whole thing that, like, deeply affected the whole movie because it's what derailed his career for 16 years. It's what ended his career after a season. And, like, they barely, like, you don't even get, like, after, like, you see her shoot him and he goes down and then you go back and, like she's just not there.
Right.
And then they're like, oh, she jumped out the window. Like they don't even, and they, it isn't even until like later on that they're like, oh yeah, it was suicide. And you're like, wait, what? Like, hold on now.
was he the best there ever would be? Like, she's like, okay, no one's ever going to be as great as him. So I've accomplished, I mean, we're totally speculating, but yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Once again, that part of the story I felt would have been more central. Like it happens. And then it's almost just like, okay, that happened. Moving on to him, you know, helping this team win. Like I felt like they would have told more of that story.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that's so important to the story that they just kind of are like, yeah, let's not talk about that anymore.
Yeah. And once again, I think they said it was, some people said that it's a very much a sanitized version of the book. Which, you know, the book goes into more detail because they actually had somewhat of a relationship before she shoots him. So there was more backstory there. And then, too, because it's a fable, they're just like, well, it's just most fables have plot holes. So why think too much about it?
Yeah, I definitely got that sort of feeling. They just thought, yeah, it's just a fable. It's just a parable about baseball and, you know, so yeah, it was, there was a lot of stuff that if you kind of think about it literally and logically, that you would,
it's not going to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was definitely one of them.
This episode's 80s flick flashback feedback. Someone that wrote in a nice review for us, I wanted to share with everybody. So this one is from Thomas E. Donahue, and he gave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and said, "This is what I'm talking about," with an exclamation point. I'm sure that's how he meant to say it, because that's how I said it. "This is what I'm talking about." He said, "Now this is the kind of cast and content that I'm glad someone directed me to. Wish I found it sooner, but that just means I have a cachet to listen to instead of having to wait for more." So thanks, Thomas, for that great review. Appreciate you taking the time to share that on Apple Podcasts. Always good to get those reviews. All right. Well, thank you, Nicholas and Ben, for joining today. Appreciate you guys being on here. Nicholas, what you got coming up on Pop Culture Roulette?
Just the normal pop culture musings of whatever we feel like talking about. So we're doing some different topics and different things. We got a couple brackets that are coming down the pipe that I don't want to give too much away. So
okay. Very cool. So definitely check out Pop Culture Roulette with Nicholas on his podcast. And Ben does not have a podcast, but it's always good to have him on the show. One of our newest co-hosts. Glad to have you back. We'll get you, got you down for another one here coming up, I'm pretty sure, pretty soon.
Cool. I will look forward to it.
Yep. All right, folks, that's a wrap on today's episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. If you had as much fun as we did, be like Thomas and show us some love with an awesome review and a shiny 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button and spread the word to all your 80s Flick loving pals. Got questions, just want to chat about your favorite flicks? You can reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok. And if you're feeling super cool, why not support the show over at buymeacoffee.com? Even a little as $5 a month makes a big difference. Plus, you can totally rock some killer 80s flick flashback gear and original designs by checking out our online store at 80sflickflashback.com and tpublic.com for all the nostalgic swag you could ever want. Thanks again for tuning in, everybody. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. It took me 16 years to get here. You play me, I'll give you the best I got.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.